Okay, the next case before us is 20-418 et al. AAAG California versus Kasana. And we will try very hard to avoid any technical glitches this time, technological glitches. Counsel for appellant, please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Dick Baldwin, and I represent appellants Abdul Kasana, Specialized Sales and Leasing and Luxury Auto Group. May it please the court, as AAAG has agreed in their response brief, the dispositive question that resolves this appeal is whether the conversion claim arises from a duty that is independent from the parties' contractual duties. It does not, and so this court should reverse. The district court relied on, or the district court concluded that the independent duty that allowed the tort claims to survive despite the economic loss rule was the duty to not take the property of another. That duty doesn't work for a number of reasons. First, conceptually, that naturally is a duty. It's an axiom under the law that you can't take the property of another. But contract law is fundamentally premised on the notion of altering that exact duty. And so just at a conceptual level, that duty is inherently intertwined with contract duties, especially in cases such as this, where the property that's at issue that was being taken is the property that's at issue under the contract. So you're right.
Well, is that right? I mean, nobody's saying that they stole 42 cars. What they're saying is they stole 35 titles.
Well, that's a distinction without a difference under this contract. The contract was for the benefit of the bargain, so to speak, which is how this court has described it in prior opinions. The benefit of the bargain here in conceiving of what the contractual duties were the cars, but the cars don't mean anything without the titles, and the titles don't mean anything without the cars. So to separate the two is a bit of a false distinction. And the benefit of the bargain for Mr. Kasana was to receive the cars, be able to sell them and transfer them and profit from them in exchange for paying for the cars. And so
he could only do that if he got the titles, and they weren't willing to give him the titles. Would you agree, at least with this much, that Mr. Kasana violated a non-contractual a duty that exists under tort law by conspiring to steal the titles?
Well, you know, under the record that we have before us right now, I think is actually a bit less clear than that makes it sound. The record at pages 77 and 78 of the record provide the evidence for that assertion that Mr. Kasana is the person who had violated some sort of duty. The only evidence in the record that describes that is that an employee of AAAG sent the titles.
And but you haven't challenged in your opening brief, have you? Or maybe I'm wrong, but I didn't think you have challenged the sufficiency of the evidence for the district judge's finding that Mr. Kasana had basically collaborated with the employee to improperly obtain those titles.
No, we didn't challenge it as a finding, because the way I conceive of that is that the way the judge used the factual assertions to then make what to me read more like conclusory legal conclusions about stealing. You know, that's not a factual assertion. That's a legal conclusion about the effect of what those facts were. And we haven't challenged under the clear error standard the facts themselves. We didn't challenge the facts that were presented to the district court, and we still don't challenge them. And I'm not going to mince words. You know, the sympathies I understand cut against our client in this case. There's no question. And trial counsel at page 444 of the record has conceded that we certainly would be liable under contract. You know, the damages question perhaps is in play and to some extent, but trial counsel already conceded liability under the contract for exactly that reason. There certainly was enough going on here that shows that certainly there's a breach of contract. But the question about breaching a separate tort duty that he owed, you know, the evidence that was presented only shows that their employee sent the titles to us. There's nothing in the record that shows any sort of affirmative act on our part or anything that Mr. Kasana had done to coerce or entice that person to send it to us.
And well, they wouldn't have to do either. And if I understood you just correctly, just what you just said to Judge Bachrach is for purposes of this proceeding, you are not challenging that there was cooperation, collaboration, and the word that is more appropriate probably is conspiracy to get the titles. And so he doesn't have to affirmatively do anything beyond agree that the employee will send him the titles. And as I understand it, you're not contesting that, right?
We're not. No. Well, we haven't challenged that.
For purposes of this proceeding, you are not challenging that.
For purposes of this proceeding, we haven't challenged the factual findings under the clear error standard.
Okay, well, if he conspired with, agreed with the employee to get the titles, and the fact that the employee put the titles in the mail and Mr. Cassana didn't, doesn't change the fact that they conspired to do that together. Well, then the question becomes, and this goes back to your initial comment about what a contract essentially qualifies or creates the boundaries of. You don't need a contract to tell somebody they can't take your property. You know, I mean, that's a crime. I mean, you don't need a contract to do that. So I'm struggling to understand why a contractual relationship would have to preclude what went on here. And if it didn't have to preclude what went on here, why doesn't that suggest that what went on here, as you have accepted for purposes of this proceeding, is an extra contractual obligation?
It isn't under this contract. And the reason why the legal test requires that result is because the Utah Supreme Court has considered in weighing the policy decisions or the policy considerations about the risk of blurring the line between contract remedies and tort remedies. And the Utah Supreme Court has spent 20 years fleshing out this test and drawing a rigid and very rigid line in Utah as compared to Colorado and South Dakota, as we point out in our briefings. Utah has a very robust economic loss rule where they have instructed courts to be wary of blurring the line between contract and tort law, and that where there are even overlapping duties, much less coextensive duties, but overlapping duties between a tort claim and a contract claim, the contract claim boxes out the tort claims. And Utah has made the decision, under Utah law, the decision has been made that there's a preference for shuffling the parties to a contract into contract remedies. And the Utah court in Health Bank even recently considered that there may be the possibility for questions about whether there would be adequate remedies depending upon what happened in the given case. And they said there is no inequity in limiting parties to the contract damages rather than opening the door to all these tort damages for precisely the reason that the Utah Supreme Court and the Utah legislature, now that it has codified the economic loss rule, has decided that that distinction between contract and tort is so important that they want to make sure that there is a complete separation between the two.
Well, why would there have to be a contractual relationship to not conspire to take my property? And in other words, why is that? Why? Certainly, I don't. Where in this contract is there a predicate for that? I noted in your brief that you started out saying Mr. Cassana didn't honor his contractual relationship to pay. Well, he did a whole lot more than that, didn't he? I mean, at least for purposes of this proceeding, he conspired with their employee to take their titles.
The Utah Supreme Court has addressed that as well to say that ill motives and bad acts are not.
I'm not in the business of judging your client. What I'm getting at though is what's contract and what's not, and so I'm trying to understand. Yeah, I don't care about his motives. If his motives tracked the contract, that's one thing. If he didn't pay because he was a bad man, then I could see the economic loss rule swallowing this up. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're not talking about him not paying because he's a bad man. We're talking about him conspiring to get property, which was not his own. That's what I need to understand.
In a sense, that's precisely what we are talking about. He has conceded to liability under the contract, which would provide full redress for the economic harms. And so adding something more to that through tort is precisely punishing him for being a bad man. That's what the economic loss rule is designed to protect against. And here, look, trial counsel conceded that he is likely there should be a judgment against him for the contract damages, that there was a breach. You know, I'm not sure how much more forcefully I can say that to say there is a redress for the economic harms here. Every one of the torts that's being asserted stems from that injury that would be redressed through the economic or through the contract judgment.
So in other words, your point, I think, is that it's all contract related because basically you would not have a conversion claim in the absence of damages, and the damages would be cured because you would comply with the contract and pay. Is that right?
Precisely.
Okay, can I flesh that out a little bit? So yeah. Just in give you maybe a hypothetical situation. Let's say that we're acquaintances and you have a ring that I would like to buy for $100, and we enter into a written contract that Bob Bacharach will pay Mr. Baldwin $100 for his ring. And you say, okay, I'll give you the ring, Bob, when you have $100. And so we go have lunch. And
no, I'm just during the middle of the third argument.
Excuse me?
Somebody's unmuted.
Oh. I thought that was my alter ego or something.
Go ahead, Judge Bacharach. No, it's not a voice. Go ahead.
They're going, but I'm muted.
You're not muted.
My apologies.
That's okay. So we're having lunch, and you put your ring out on the table and go to the restroom, and I take that ring. I steal it. And you come back and say, you know, okay, Bob, I'm going to sue you for conversion. You converted my ring. You stole it. And I say, oh, Mr. Baldwin, you're right. I'll pay you the $100. So I've paid you my contractual price. Would the economic loss rule prevent you from suing me for conversion?
Yeah, under Utah law, it would require you to seek damages under contract.
You can basically, as long as you've got a contract, you can steal anything as long as you eventually, when you get caught, you pay up.
Well, to uncharitably characterize it, in a sense, I guess, I would say that the distinction that I think is critical in this case also is that I understand that this case maybe invites those exact type of hypotheticals, but a critical distinction here is under your, let me tweak your hypothetical and say, let's say that over the last 2 years, you and I had done that 8 million times and I had purchased $8 million worth of, or I guess I can't do the math on the fly. I'm an attorney, but did it 8 million times with 8 million rings over the prior 2 years. And we had an understanding about how these contracts work. This wasn't some, you know, harebrained bank robbery where I tried to come up with some way of stealing your property. This is a commercial enterprise where we've engaged in this pattern and practice and we had an understanding. And that is critical context for understanding that this case stands separate and apart from exactly those types of, you know, parade of horribles type hypotheticals that I think I can see how the court could be concerned about leading down that road. And unless there are further questions, I'd like to reserve a little bit of time for rebuttal. So
that's fine, Mr. Baldwin. Counsel, please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Jess Kranick, and I represent the appellee here, AAAG California. In their two briefs filed in this case, appellants failed to confront or even mention the undisputed facts related to the theft of appellee's titles that gave rise to its conversion claim and were the basis of this district court's orders. The reason for that is obvious. Those facts establish intentional, tortious, and even criminal conduct in orchestrating a theft of another's property and present violations of duties not present that don't come from the contracts and therefore take this case outside the application of the economic loss rule. Now, Mr. Baldwin sort of minimized the evidence in the trial court on that front, and I want to start by just talking about that for a second. Because it is undisputed, and it's not as minimal as he would like to suggest. The undisputed facts giving rise to the conversion claim, the theft of titles, show that these parties entered into very basic purchase agreements whereby appellant was to pay for vehicles won at auction. And his only duty under those contracts was, in fact, to pay for the vehicles. He was allowed to take the vehicles prior to payment, but not to own or receive the titles until the payment was actually made and cleared and title then processed and reassigned. And in late 2019, he agreed to pay for nearly $2 million in vehicles, which is what's at issue here. But then he failed and breached that duty to pay. And then, while he was in breach and on notice of that breach, he then worked with a low-level employee of appellees to surreptitiously steal the titles from plaintiff's safe and FedEx them to himself. And the evidence was not minimal. It was declaration testimony. There was videographic. There was email. There was documentary evidence showing that this employee circumvented the system and my client's policies, used personal accounts to avoid detection. And there were slips that were found in a garbage bin, all substantiated in detailed and sworn statements. The evidence in the district court now also shows that she was paid for this. And then with these stolen titles in hand, Mr. Cassana then tried to sell all of the vehicles, hide all of the proceeds, and leave my client with no damages to collect for breach of the payment duty. And because he had been dissipating all of these assets in violation of the very order that they now try to have dissolved, in fact, with a shell entity to pursue, despite the fact that my client, prior to the theft of titles, held status as legal owner of these vehicles by virtue of those title facts. Now, those facts, Your Honor, you're correct, Judge Holmes. These were undisputed below. They're not challenged on appeal. They were central to the orders being challenged. And they're subject to clear error review, which is not even raised here by appellants. So really, the sole issue here is, did the district court abuse its discretion by applying the standard economic loss rule in Utah to these undisputed facts to grant relief? Appellants frame their appeal by ignoring these detailed and undisputed facts of title theft, misstating the basis of our conversion claim as if it relates.
Did it abuse its discretion? Wouldn't the underlying issue here, whether these facts supported application of the economic loss rule, would that not be an issue of law?
That is an issue of law, Your Honor. And from our perspective, I agree with you. The analysis here from our perspective is pretty straightforward, because it's only calling really for this analysis that applies the standard economic loss rule, comparing the claims and asking whether the duty that's alleged to have been breached in the tort claim arises from the contract itself or from an independent source. And that's not a complicated analysis here, but I agree with you. That's a legal analysis. And the question here really is did the district court commit a legal error in which it abused its discretion by entering these orders and applying that law to these undisputed facts?
Okay. And based upon Judge Bacharach's hypothetical earlier, I as stark as these facts may appear to be, I don't think that Mr. Baldwin is contesting these circumstances. He's just saying that the rigorous economic loss rule in Utah would say that's not good enough. And I want to make sure I understand your response to what I understood to be his suggestion, that it is a distinction with a difference, that there was a course of commercial dealing here between the parties, and that somehow or other that colors the notion that this should just be essentially a failing of a contractual duty by virtue of what is the stark facts of a conspiracy to possess property.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, he's correct that the background here does arise from a commercial relationship. However, the undisputed facts of that commercial relationship that were before the district court is that entire course of dealing involved the circumstances that I described until this conspiracy to steal these titles. So in other words, the entire history of that course of dealing was that the parties had very basic purchase agreements that included only appellant's duty to pay, and that his ability to take the titles that he had committed to auction to buy did not result in him ever receiving titles to these vehicles, that my client continued to own those titles and appellant didn't own or receive those titles until he had made payment, that payment had cleared, and title had been reprocessed and reassigned to him. So in other words, the undisputed evidence is that this title theft and him coordinating to circumvent policies and have these titles sent to him You know, which of course allowed him to then pass himself off as the legal owner of property belonging to another, sell it downstream, and then dissipate those proceeds before my client could catch him doing so. That only arises from him engaging in conduct that was distinct from all of the parties' transactions before. And that's an extra contractual action.
Okay. It's distinct from their course of dealing before, if I understand you correctly. But I guess the argument would be, and I don't want to put words in Mr. Baldwin's mouth, I'll follow up with him when he gets back on. But I think the argument would be that this course of dealing sort of cements, in some sense, a commercial contractual relationship. Therefore, the zone of deviation, if you will, it expands. In other words, if you have failings within the context of an ongoing commercial relationship, they become failings of the relationship, as opposed to the one-off example that Judge Bachrach alluded to of somebody just coming up. You know, if the first time they had dealt with each other, this transaction had taken place, I think the argument would be that's a much stronger case to say it's not part of the contract than what took place here. So I guess I'm trying to understand, do you think it matters at all how long their relationship went on if there had not been prior thefts in it?
I don't think it does under the undisputed facts here, Your Honor, because if you look at each of these transactions that are at issue, this course of dealing, each of them involve the same sort of very basic contractual concept. Mr. Cassana enters into a purchase agreement whereby he agrees to buy a vehicle that he's won the right to buy at auction. And the sole duty that he undertakes that arises from that very simple purchase agreement is the duty to pay. You know, so at the point that he didn't hear, he was certainly in breach of contract. But those purchase agreements are exceedingly simple. I mean, we're not talking about the kind of, complicated, fully fleshed out real estate contracts that have been at issue in other Utah Supreme Court cases where the economic loss rule has been applied. And we're also talking about, you know, a real distinction in the type of extra contractual conduct that's at issue here. Those very simple purchase agreements create absolutely no duty for appellant with respect to titles. So in other words, him orchestrating the theft of the titles from my client's safe by virtue of its employee didn't breach a specific duty that arises from the contract.
Why wouldn't it be? There is a provision, I think, which spells out the notion that buyer agrees that the title and ownership of the vehicle shall remain in the seller. And I guess the flip side of that is, well, if I took it from the seller, I'm breaching the stipulation that says the title will remain with the seller, right?
The evidence before the district court, which again is undisputed and not challenged on appeal, was that provision exists only for liability reasons. So this is not a circumstance where the parties had some sort of negotiation as to waiver of tort remedies or waiver of a theft of title that then gets reflected in a fully fleshed out commercial contract. There's a very limited basis for the title obligation, and the title obligation that exists is solely on my client's behalf. There's no duty that arises for Mr. Baldwin's client. So my client holds legal ownership, and only by virtue of the theft of those titles is appellant able to then pass themselves off as the owner, the effect of which is to deprive my client of its ownership interest in the vehicles. To use the example given by the district court, which I think is pretty spot on, under appellant's theory, where you lose a property right by virtue of something being surreptitiously stolen from you, you go from being the actual owner, which gives you rights as a matter of law that exceed those of a secured creditor. And their argument is, well, because you had a very basic contract here in which I only had an obligation to pay you, if I go steal your property, in addition to failing to pay you, your rights become those of an unsecured creditor. And if I leave a shell entity for you to collect from, basically you can go from a property owner that has property rights that in conversion and constructive trust law give you the ability to actually reclaim your property or to trace its proceeds. And instead now, solely by virtue of my intentional action, I have taken you from a property owner to somebody who has to get in line with other unsecured creditors, and you're not even going to get back the recourse of the value that you should have gotten for the property that I stole from you. I've frustrated both your contractual and I've frustrated your tort remedies by virtue of my intentional action. And that's not the way.
Let me ask you a question that's maybe, sorry to interrupt, but we're going to run out of time. do you think that Mr. Baldwin's client breached by conspiring to steal these titles?
I don't know that breaches a specific term of the contract. I mean, I guess another way to look at it, and this is fleshed out in many of the cases that conduct this kind of analysis, but the basic analysis here is we look at the duties that are at issue in each of the claims here. And is the tort claim duty that's alleged, does it come from the contract or does it come from someplace else? The simplest way to look at that is if we didn't have a contract, would he still have violated my client's rights? The answer to that is obviously yes. He goes and he steals the title to the vehicles. Well, he's taken my client's property interest and my client ought to have the ability to gain recourse there. And by virtue of the fact that, really the only mention of title in the agreements between the parties is a very simple one, and it's uncontested, the district court's ruling, that the basis for that is solely for essentially insurance and liability reasons, obligations that my client has, not obligations that Mr. Baldwin's client has. There's really nothing specific in the contract that says that he breaches if he goes and takes the titles. He certainly breached by virtue of not paying when payment was due.
Go ahead.
Sorry. I understand your point, and it intuitively and otherwise, it logically makes sense that if there wasn't a contract, would there be a duty, and that plays into whether this is an extra contractual duty. But I guess I would ask, if you do make something the subject of a contract, and for example, just playing it out, and just tell me where I'm wrong in this. Under that provision we talked about, despite what the district court said about, that's in there only for liability purposes. Well, that doesn't end the inquiry into whether this can be deemed to be a contractual duty. Why couldn't Mr. Baldwin's client argue that this provision says the title will remain with you? Well, I violated that provision because I took it. So title was subject matter. Title possession was a subject matter of this contract. And I violated that provision by taking the title from you. And so so why doesn't then this harm that you allege arise out of a provision of the contract? So I just want to make sure I understand, how would you respond to that logic?
The analysis of the independent duties is one that really calls for a careful examination of the duties, the basis for both the tort claim and the contract claim. That's not an analysis that appellants engage in any of their briefing here, and I've not heard it here today. And I think it oversimplifies the analysis to just say, do you have any mention of a subject in a contract? The real question here is, do you have overlapping duties? This is not a case like Health Bank where the tort claim is entirely duplicative of a contract claim, or the allegation is, you breached a contract by committing essentially a tortious breach. It's likewise not a case, like some of these cases involving real estate purchase contracts. I'm sorry, I see my time is up, Your Honor. May I
finish? No, please finish.
It's not one of these cases where you've got a detailed real estate purchase contract where you have sort of extensive negotiation and waiver of tort remedies. The real question here is, if you engage in that careful examination of the duties in the contract claim and the duties in the tort claim, is there an overlap of those alleged duties? I would refer the court to cases like Davenport and KTM and Health Bank, where the court has said that analysis ought to consider whether you have independent duties that arise from common law, statute, or other means, which include duties that arise from the independent nature of society. In other words, common law, the obligation, the basic obligation that you referred to earlier, not to take another's property. That's not a duty that arises from the contract. It's a duty that arises from the common law and from the law of conversion. And this is the same analysis undertaken in cases like Razone, which is an out-of-district case, but also the Ninth Circuit's decision in Giles and the Seventh Circuit's decision in Tyson, The latter two, appellants don't address those in their briefing, but they're pretty spot on from the standpoint that, you know, they apply the exact same independent duty analysis that is applied in Utah courts. Distinctions that appellants try to draw as to Utah's law versus those jurisdictions' law are meaningless, because that's not the issue. The issue is, if you apply the independent duty analysis to a contract and a tort claim where conversion and something arising to the level of intentional theft has occurred, does the contract address the duty not to take some aspect of that property right that doesn't belong to you? Here the answer is no, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate your argument. Mr. Baldwin, you may proceed. And if you'd give Mr. Baldwin an additional 30 seconds, he doesn't need to take it, but if he wants it, he has it.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think I'd like to follow up on the last exchange there. Utah does describe the test as requiring the court to examine the subject matter of the contract. And I think the discussion that we've just had illustrates there is no disentangling the tort claim and the contract claim from the subject matter of the contract. This isn't just something that was a passing reference in the contract. The titles and the car were the fundamental purpose of this contract, and they defined the terms under which Mr. Cassana could obtain those cars, and he breached that. And it is absolutely an overlapping duty, even though, you know, you can squint your eyes and see it as more of a tort claim rather than a contract claim. Utah is clear that where there is overlap, such as exists here, the economic loss rule requires the tort claims to be precluded, and the remedy that's available is a contract remedy.
What if the duty arises by virtue of criminal law, like the criminal prohibition against committing larceny? Wouldn't that be independent of the contract?
You know, first, Utah has not discussed that. My guess is that I think that there probably is a difference there, because larceny would involve, some affirmative act. You know, for example, if Mr. Cassana had personally broken into the facility and stolen the titles out of the safe.
Or in my hypothetical, when I stole your ring, I committed larceny. So I think you had earlier indicated that the economic loss rule would prevent me from, or you from suing me, I'm sorry, it's your lawsuit against me, for conversion, because I could cure it by paying $100. Well, maybe it's not so clear, because I've committed larceny. And that's not, you know, paying $100 isn't going to prevent the commission of larceny.
I think the key there is going to depend upon exactly what happened, because the conduct has to give rise to a truly independent duty. And if the conduct that took place that led to the breach is coextensive with what would, you know, if you look at the case a little bit differently, you can frame it as a tort instead of a contract. That is precisely what the economic loss rule is for. And I'd also like to focus on a couple of other points really quickly. The notion that Ms. Tapia was paid for this conduct, that is absolutely not in this record. That may be in the trial court record. It is not before this court. Additionally, the history of the economic loss rule informs how this court should be thinking of this in terms of how the duties relate to one another. And I see I'm out of time. Sorry, I can briefly conclude.
Just finish your thought.
All right. Thank you very much, Your Honor. So the economic loss rule in its early years in Utah was applied to the construction context, where the court was trying to address situations, you know, commercial contexts, where there were multiple contracts and you had contractors and subcontractors. And the idea was, we aren't going to allow parties to use tort law to supplement their contracts. When you have engaged in a contract, you are limited to the contract damages. And the Utah courts have not limited those principles in any way when applying it outside of the construction context. And that is why it is so rigidly applied and so critical, that when there is a case where a claim could absolutely be made that there is a way of stating a tort theory, but it also overlaps with a contractual duty, the Utah courts foreclose the tort duties, full stop. And with that, I submit the case. Thank you.
Thank you for your arguments. Very well argued on both sides. I appreciate that.